Iran's president tells an international conference on Islamic unity that Palestine is the priority of the Muslim world and should not be sidelined. UN experts are warning that overcompliance with U.S. sanctions threatens the Iranian people's basic rights to health. And people in the Iraqi capital Baghdad protest against election results and demand a manual recount of the October 10th parliamentary vote. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. The Iranian president is urging Muslim nations to remain united and refrain from division.
We seek to ensure stability in Islamic countries, unlike the enemy which tries to create instability. We believe unity is the strategy that the Islamic community should adopt, but the enemy's strategy is to sow discord.
Raisi was making his keynote speech at the opening ceremony of an international conference on Islamic unity that's underway in Tehran. He says Palestine is the most pressing issue of the Muslim world and should not be sidelined. The president believes that the conference is an ideal opportunity to further promote Islamic awakening. He also urged the Muslim world to stand up to terrorist groups such as Daesh. Raisi says that corruption, poverty, and terrorism should be uprooted in the Islamic world. The president also encouraged closer scientific, cultural, and media cooperation among Muslim nations. The conference will last 6 days. A group of UN-mandated experts have warned that overcompliance with U.S. sanctions could strip the Iranian people of their basic rights to health. Experts say that many banks and businesses, including pharmaceutical firms around the world, are complying with sanctions out of fear of penalties. It cited a Swedish company that halted the sale of bandages to its Iranian partner, and that resulted in the inability of patients, including children suffering from a rare skin disease, to access the bandage. They warned that such a decision by the firm violated its own human rights policies. Iran has time and again blamed sanctions for impeding its fight against chronic diseases, including the COVID pandemic, calling U.S. measures medical terrorism. In other news, the Russian defense minister says his country is prepared to develop dynamic and versatile military collaboration with Iran. Sergei Shoigu was speaking in a meeting with chairman of the chiefs of staff of the Iranian armed forces, Major General Babari, in Moscow. Shoigu added that Iran and Russia can expand their anti-terror fight in the region. Then the Iranian general emphasized the importance of boosting defense and military cooperation between the two. Babari, who is in Moscow on an official visit, has already held talks with other Russian military top brass. Now over to Iraq, where people have hit the streets of the capital Baghdad to vent their anger at the outcome of the recently held parliamentary elections. Protesters, including supporters of the popular mobilization forces, waved national flags and chanted slogans calling for a new vote as they marched near Baghdad's Green Zone. They also called for a manual recount of the ballots and pledged to keep up their rallies until their demands are met. The Electoral Commission began recounting the votes after some political parties contested the outcome. The initial vote tally has put influential cleric Muqtada al-Sadr's bloc in the lead with more than 70 seats. The final results should be certified by the federal court. Time now for the news review. Hezbollah Secretary General Said Hassan Nasrallah says that the Lebanese Forces Party was behind the killing of seven Shiite protesters in Beirut last Thursday. Mariam Salah has a report.
In a televised speech, Hezbollah Secretary General accused the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader directly of conspiring to initiate a civil war.
I need to tell you very clearly, the real project for the Lebanese Forces Party is instigating a civil war, because a civil war will lead to demographic changes that would put the Christians in one area to create a Christian canton controlled by the Lebanese Forces Party. There would be no place for anyone else in this area. This is our understanding of our experience with the Lebanese Forces Party and the path it is taking. One example is that they were ready to give the service of starting a civil war on behalf of the former Saudi ambassador Sabhan.
The leader of the resistance said the Lebanese Forces Party is trying to incite Lebanese Christians against Hezbollah, presenting it as an enemy. Said Nasrallah gave a detailed explanation of last Thursday's events, stressing that the security apparatus gave Hezbollah a confirmation that the first bullets fired by militiamen from the Lebanese forces against the unarmed protesters. This, he says, was all part of a plan to drag Hezbollah specifically to internal conflict orchestrated by foreign sides. Nasrallah said the U.S. is also trying to provoke an internal conflict in Lebanon the same way it did in many other nations. Yet Sayyid Nasrallah stressed the scheme will not succeed.
Hezbollah has 100,000 fighters. We did not prepare them to fight a civil war. We prepared them to defend Lebanon and our land and water and petrol and natural gas, which is being stolen under our watch. We prepared them to protect the Christian and Muslim towns in Baalbek al-Hermel. We were killed in Kaldeh and we were silent. We were killed on Thursday and we were patient. It does not mean we are weak or incapable. We are thinking straight and we have ethics. I tell the Lebanese Forces Party and its leader, don't miscalculate. Be disciplined. Learn from your wars and learn from our wars.
He warned that in the event of a military conflict, neither Israel nor the U.S. or Saudi Arabia will come to the help of any warring side.
Sayyid Nasrallah was clear in proving that the Lebanese forces had always tried to target the resistance. But he was also clear in the fact that Hezbollah will not be lured into internal fighting and that the resistance is a protector of civil peace and unity of Lebanon. And those who are pushing for civil war are at the service of a U.S. project in Lebanon and the region.
Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah said in his speech tonight that the main guarantor for peace and stability is the Lebanese state and the Lebanese army. Therefore, Hezbollah will put its trust in the judiciary to bring those who martyred people on Thursday to justice. Maryam Saleh, Beirut.
Okay, now let's discuss this a little bit and shed some more light on it. So joining me will be a couple of guests. We'll have Elijah Magnier, a journalist and political analyst in Brussels. Also, Mohammed Abeit, political analyst, joining us out of Beirut. Good to see you, gentlemen. Elijah, we have Eli Hobayka, who is notorious for his role in the Sabra and Shatila massacres in 1982. He assumed the leadership of the Lebanese forces, or LF, after the 1982 assassination of Bashir Gemayel. So what does this tell everybody about the agenda of the Lebanese forces?
Thank you for having me. Actually, sure. I was in Lebanon in 1982 and I witnessed the massacre of Sabra and Shatila. It's good that you mention it and remind the world of that massacre and the responsibility of Israel and the Lebanese forces of the massacre of several thousands of Palestinians and Lebanese who were in both camps. What I think is the Lebanese forces leader, Samir Jaja, is trying to sell his capability to fire against Hezbollah and Shia demonstrated, really, it's not against Hezbollah. There were Shia civilian right to demonstrate and to contest against an issue that they thought it is their right to do so. And they were fired upon by snipers on the other side that belongs to the Lebanese forces. So the problem is that the Lebanese forces leaders has ambitions to become a president. This is not going to happen unless he tries to divide Lebanon, run by only the Christian that follow him, because he represents a very small part of the Christian, but not all the Christians in Lebanon, and not even half of them. So what he's trying to do is to force a kind of a reaction from Hezbollah to trigger a fear among the Christian and say, well, I am your defender. I am the one who can protect you. While in reality, what he's doing is not he's scaring the hell out of the Christian, pushing them for another exodus. But what he's doing is just creating more havoc in the country to please the Americans and the Israelis and to tell them I may be able to succeed where you both have failed, which is unrealistic, really.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mohammed Abeit, as you know, this LF group also enjoys the backing of Saudi Arabia. Tell us about the dealings between this group and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the same country that arrested former Lebanese Prime Minister Hariri a couple of years ago. Is Riyadh considered by the Lebanese as a friend or foe?
First of all, thanks for having me.
Sure,
second, the issue of Saudi Arabia is quite a little bit complicated, because sometimes it employs be the new world, and then you have the issue of failing to have any supporters that are able to confront Hezbollah in Lebanon. Therefore, on Samir Jaja in this regard, after the failure of Saad Hariri in doing and performing the task. So it is quite a little bit illogical and one way or another, because we know that in Wahhabi Wahhabism, Christians are regarded as infidels, and they are not being regarded as people who sometimes who deserve to live in some context. But as we saw with ISIS and Wahhabi school graduates, but still. You have the issue to have a Christian as the representative of the Saudi policy in Lebanon. So still, it is a desperate step by the Saudis, following the failure of all the other puppets that the Saudis were able to use in Lebanon. So they resorted to this. By the way, in Lebanon, he is regarded, Samir Jaja is regarded as a thug, meaning you cannot believe that he's a politician because of his history. He was even sentenced to life imprisonment, but was out due to a pardon, a special pardon that was issued by the Lebanese parliament. So people do not regard him on the side of the Hezbollah and by the side of the what we call the March 8th, meaning the nationalist parties who are fighting against the Israeli and American imperialism in Lebanon and in the region. So he is not regarded as a politician in the first place. But it was noteworthy that Sayyidina Abdullah in his speech, and this was noted even by the Israeli press, that Sayyidina Abdullah did not mention him by name. He did not say Samir Jaja. He said the president and the militia of the right. Lebanese forces. What I would like to focus on is the issue that Said Nasrallah was used his very famous credibility and calmness in order first to explain what Said Nasrallah is trying to do in the country. Mm-hmm. He is trying to do a sort of breaking Shias as an enemy.
Okay, let me turn to Brussels to Elijah. We have a technical problem with Mohammed Abayt. Elijah, this group, the LF, also enjoys the backing of Israel. And you know, Jaja revived ties with Israel and rivaled the then Lebanese president, Jumail.
Yes, indeed. The history of the Lebanese forces goes back before the 1980s. It was in the 1970s. When the Kataib, used to be called the Kataib first, used to have a very good relationship with Israel. They were trained and armed by the Israelis. And then they were the first units that were used against the Lebanese in the civil war by the Israelis. And they were very useful to the Israeli when they occupied the capital, Beirut, and other parts of the country. Now, the ambition of Israel is to divert the attention of Hezbollah from the protecting the borders and the maritime right of the Lebanese population to an internal struggle or a kind of a civil war, so that the Israelis can relax on the border and support one part of the Lebanese against another part of the.
Okay, so
secondly,
yes, go ahead. We just had a disconnection. Yes, make your point.
Yeah, even if in the worst case scenario, Hezbollah has made it very clear in the past that the units who are allocated to protect the borders with Israel will never move from there, and they will confront the Israelis. And Hezbollah doesn't need many troops for that. A few thousands were able to stop the Israelis in 2006 from invading the country. Therefore, the really plan of the Lebanese forces is not only unrealistic, but is only creating more havoc to the Christians in Lebanon, whose number is reduced much below the 50% of the population to even less than 20% today. And we see the minority Shia and Christian in Lebanon are the one who's supposed to be united against the Takfiri who try to attack Lebanon and create a failed state in Syria with the support of the US and other countries. And the Shia in Lebanon protected the Christian and prevented the Takfiri from occupying Christian areas.
Right.
Therefore, it doesn't make any sense for the Christian to rise against the Shia or part of the Christian, as the Lebanese forces leader dreams about, to attack the Shia and create a civil war.
Okay, thank you very much for that. Elijah Magnier, journalist and political analyst in Brussels, and Mohammed Abate, political analyst in Beirut, joined us with their comments and contribution. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
A year has passed since immigrant rights advocates filed a federal complaint about human rights violations, including invasive gynecological procedures without full consent being performed on women at an immigration prison in Georgia. But the survivors of these abuses are still waiting for justice and restitution. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Priyanka Bhatt, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Survivors of Medical Abuse at ICE Jail in Georgia are still waiting for justice. Stay tuned for more. A year has passed since immigrant rights advocates filed a federal complaint about human rights violations, including invasive gynecological procedures without full consent being performed on women at an immigration prison in Georgia, but the survivors of these abuses are still waiting for justice and restitution. The federal complaint made international headlines for advocates filed it with the Department of Homeland Security Office of Inspector General, detailing horrific accounts from detained immigrants and whistleblower nurse Don Wooten. Even so, there have been grossly inadequate actions taken to hold Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, accountable for these abuses. While the Department of Homeland Security ordered the ICE contract at Irving County Detention Center to be terminated in May 2021, the prison still remains open. Worse yet, the immigrants who were previously detained at Irving were transferred to other deadly ICE prisons in Georgia, despite calls from advocates to release them. While House Resolution 1153 passed in October 2020, condemning the invasive non-consensual procedures and calling for full cooperation into investigations of Irving County Detention Center, there have been no congressional hearings and no update on the status of the original Office of Inspector General complaint filed. The survivors of Irving County Detention Center deserve justice in the form of closure of Irving County Detention Center along with all ICE prisons, immediate accountability for the violations that occurred in ICE custody, immigration relief, and reparations. Georgia is home to three ICE prisons where eight immigrants have died in the past 4 years. There have been documented abuses affecting thousands of detained immigrants, ranging from medical neglect to forced labor. These horrible conditions can be attributed, at least in part, to a subculture of bigotry within the state that has created legal detention pipelines like anti-immigrant state laws and 287 programs that funnel immigrants into ICE prisons for minor infractions and deny them equity and opportunity. Wendy Dow is one of the survivors of that system and of an invasive non-consensual gynecological procedure while incarcerated at the Irving County Detention Center. A black immigrant from Jamaica, Dow lived in Georgia for more than a decade, always in fear of the overly aggressive targeting of immigrants by law enforcement. A report on law enforcement in Gwinnett County, where Dow lived, documented a pattern of racial profiling where immigrants often reported being stopped without probable cause or reasonable suspicion. In addition to being subjected to warrantless searches, Dow was attacked by police dogs. While police looked on, I kept telling the police to get the dogs off me, but they waited until my legs and fingers were beaten up for no particular reason, Dow recalls. That incident led to her arrest and transfer to ICE custody. But nothing prepared her for the grim realities of the Irving County Detention Center. The stress of being confined in treacherous conditions and separated from her children led to spikes in blood pressure and vision problems. One day, while showering, Dow fell, hit her head, and fainted. Despite being in terrible pain, she was not transferred to an outside hospital because she was told she didn't have any broken bones. This lack of care is common at the Irving County Detention Center. But the worst was yet to come. During a gynecology appointment, Dow had been told that she had cysts in her stomach that needed to be treated. Very early one morning, weeks later, she was abruptly woken up and told to get dressed to go to see a doctor. Dow assumed the visit concerned her high blood pressure, but instead, she was taken to a hospital and told she was having surgery to remove cysts from her stomach. She was given no other explanation. When Dow woke up from surgery, she was back at the Irving County Detention Center. There were bandages on my stomach and pain on my sides and under my navel, Dow recalls. At Irvine, no one would tell her what procedure she had been subjected to, and no one provided any medication for the terrible pain, even as the wound became infected, leaking yellow pus. To them, I was another person without documents. I was nobody, she says, adding, I was scared of not coming out. I wrote a will to my brother telling him what to do with my children because I felt like I wasn't going to come out alive. Dow is one of at least 40 Irvine County Detention Center survivors who underwent invasive procedures without their full knowledge and consent. In a recently published report, another survivor shared that after finding out her fallopian tube had been removed without her consent, she was extremely distressed and suffered periods of depression and anger, knowing that she could not naturally conceive children anymore. Yet another survivor noted that her appointment that she felt pain like childbirth and felt like her was rotting from inside. The threat of a state-sanctioned violence against women's bodies, and in particular black and brown communities, is unfortunately not new to the Peach State. Georgia was the 32nd state to pass a sterilization law in 1937 and sterilized more than 3,000 individuals, the fifth highest in the country. Eugenics politics across U.S. legalized pseudoscientific practices used primarily by white elites to control black or indigenous people, immigrants, poor women, and people with disabilities who they believed were unfit or feeble-minded. These white supremacist policies continue today in many different forms, including in ICE practices and xenophobic anti-black legislation. Just like the Georgia State Board of Eugenics in 1930s, the majority white male legislators of the current Georgia General Assembly often continue to make decisions that harm communities of color and women, from its passage of Jim Crow voter suppression bill to a draconian anti-abortion bill and scores of anti-immigrant bills. The road to accountability and reparations for these abuses promises to be long and grueling. I'm speaking out to bring awareness to us women, mother, daughters who got abused at the hands of ICE so that it doesn't happen to anyone else, Dow says, adding, I would like to hold the U.S. government, ICE, and the Irvine staff and doctors accountable for what happened to us and to all others, physically, mentally, and emotionally. I'm calling for justice.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
One of the points to remember when we are reminded of our Prophet and we want to celebrate the blessing of having our Prophet on this material earth and in this material realm is the fact that the Holy Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, is the one who has given us life. One of the terms that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala mentions in the Holy Quran in regards to guidance and following guidance is for a person to be given life. لَنُحْيَنَّهُ حَيَاةً طَيِّبَةً. Life. A pleasant life. حَيَاةً طَيِّبَةً. A pure life. This is what the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi has brought to us. This is what we owe the Prophet for. And what he has given us is this. He's brought us life. What happens is that sometimes when we are given a gift, when we are presented with a gift, when someone gives us something, we can, due to our deficiency in understanding what that is, undervalue or completely disregard the gift that has been given. We can easily do that. If something very expensive is given to us, but we have no clue what the value of that is on the market, to us it looks like just a piece of metal. For someone who, let's say, has no clue what gold is, or a better example, what platinum is. If you look at platinum and platinum rings, the ones at least I have seen, they don't look very valuable. If you know what the material is and how much that thing cost, you realize what the value of it is. But before you know that, if someone just gives it to you, you've never seen it before, you don't know what type of value it has, you think that they give you some metal ring, it's not gold, it's not silver, doesn't have the shine that those other metals have. Again, at least the ones I've seen. And so you misunderstand. Anyhow, this is an example. If you don't gather, or if you don't comprehend or understand the importance of it, you're not going to take it seriously. We won't take it seriously, and therefore we won't appreciate that person as much. There's a lot that has been said, and we should say, in regards to our Prophet and loving our Prophet and how great he is and how much love we have, how much respect we have for him. But I think one of the most important ways of celebrating the existence of the Prophet, celebrating the gift of the Prophet, is to celebrate the giving of the Prophet and what it actually was. And the best way to do that is to take it on board. As Muslimin, generally, we do not value the gift that the Holy Prophet has given us. Generally, we don't. I'm not talking about this person or that person. When we look at the Muslim Ummah, Shia or Sunni, either way, we do not value what the Holy Prophet gave us. The greatness of the Prophet for us is what he has given us. The most important thing he has given us is that guidance, that is life. And the reason why it's called that is that that's what it is. We're not alive. We don't have life if we don't follow that teaching. We all understand the importance of oxygen. We understand the importance of water. We understand the importance of nutrients and how, if our bodies don't get them, our bodies will not be able to survive. We understand all of that. That's very simple because it is something that is tangible and evident. Our material existence depends on it. when it comes to the teachings that the Holy Prophet has given us, we don't seem to clearly, I'm not trying to like judge based on some mysterious or some high level analysis, it's very basic. We don't implement the teachings. We don't look for the teachings. We don't spend time studying the teachings. We have no idea what's there. We've memorized a few lines of the history of the Prophet, a few lines of the sayings of the Prophet, a few lines of the Quran, without understanding any of it. And part of what we have understood or memorized, not understood, in regards to the history of the Prophet, what he said, what he did, some of it is completely misconstrued. This is not referring to Muslimin that are not Shia. I'm talking about mainly, the focus is on the Shias. What have we understood? What have we studied? What are we following? The reason why we're not following that, we're not looking for it, we're not spending time, we're not spending hours, daily, weekly, monthly, studying it. The reason why we're not panicking, oh my God, I don't have the nutrients to survive, is it because we don't see it in that way. We don't see this as life. We see it, life goes on, we're perfectly fine. We call ourselves Muslim. I have access to the Quran. I read the Quran maybe once a blue moon. And that's it. What are the teachings of the Prophet? What is this Hayatun Tayyibah? Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has gifted us with it. We don't value it, brothers and sisters. If we did, we wouldn't treat it that way, the way we are. Holy Prophet gave us a way of life, a way of life that changes the way we look at things, we look at each other, the way we think of each other.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karimun Azim Alimun Halim Hakimun Mateen.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The row over the British government's handling of COP26 planning has emerged amid public order concerns, with up to 150,000 protesters expected to take to Glasgow streets in early November, alongside the crucial climate talks, which will require one of the largest policing operations ever undertaken in Britain. We now present you an article written by Gillian Ambrose. The piece is titled COP26 Corporate Sponsors Condemn Climate Summit as Mismanaged. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Companies that have stumped up millions of pounds to sponsor the COP26 climate summit have condemned it as mismanaged and very last minute in a volley of complaints as next month's event in Glasgow draws near. The sponsors, which include some of Britain's biggest companies, have raised formal complaints blaming very inexperienced civil servants for delayed decisions, poor communications and a breakdown in relations between the organisers of the event and firms in the run-up to the landmark talks. The Guardian understands that a letter to the organisers, written by broadcaster Sky and co-signed by senior leaders from other COP26 sponsors, has raised concerns with them over these and other problems, and followed another co-signed letter in July. Britain is running its COP26 presidency from within the Cabinet Office, under the leadership of the former Business Secretary Alok Sharma, who is the COP26 president, and the businessman Nigel Topping, who was appointed the government's so-called high-level climate action champion last year. Sponsorship is expected to help defray a policing bill estimated to reach up to £250 million. Alongside Sky, the summit has 10 other major sponsors, including energy giants Hitachi, National Grid, Scottish Power, and SSE. US technology titan Microsoft, and the FTSE companies GSK, National Westminster Bank, Reckitt, Sainsbury's and Unilever. Unilever has denied signing the letter penned by Sky. Other lower-tier partners include the carmaker Jaguar Land Rover and the furniture retailer IKEA. One source employed by the COP26 sponsor said that the biggest frustration was the lack of information about how the event will run and the role for its key backers, because important questions have gone unanswered and planning decisions have been delayed. The source said, "They had an extra year to prepare for COP26 due to COVID, but it doesn't feel like this time was used to make better progress. Everything feels very last minute. The upcoming climate talks in Glasgow, considered by many as the last chance to put the world on track to meet its climate ambitions, are due to take place in early November, after the event was postponed by a year because of the outbreak of COVID-19 in early 2020. They have already been thrown into turmoil by suggestions that the Chinese President Xi Jinping will skip the event, threatening the chances of a global pact with one of the world's biggest industrial nations. Organizers of COP26 promised sponsors an outstanding opportunity and unique benefits in exchange for their support, including a chance to promote their brands at the conference Green Zone exhibition space and the participation of government ministers at their events. But in multiple emails and official letters, the companies have complained to the organizers about unmet expectations and deepening concerns over delays to Green Zone plans. They've also raised complaints that ministers have not always been available for their events in the run-up to COP26, as agreed as part of the sponsors' deals. Other sources have described the shifting goalposts and inertia plaguing the COP26 planning as deeply frustrating. Another source explained many of the event's corporate backers regularly take part in high-profile sponsorship deals for big events and have been left bewildered by the slow progress of the COP26 events. The source blamed the very young, very inexperienced civil servants tasked with planning the event for taking a top-down public sector approach that has raised hackles among sponsors. The source said it is clear that many of them have very little experience managing relationships in the private sector, or even experience attending a COP event. The energy companies sponsoring COP26, Hitachi, National Grid, Scottish Power and SSE, are understood to be particularly frustrated because they were under the impression that no other energy brands would feature at COP26. However, the Blue Zone, which is organized by the United Nations, would include rival brands. Ministers had been due to release three key documents in coming days on the government's plans to achieve its net zero target by 2035, but publication has been delayed owing to the murder of Conservative MP Sir David Ames. The document reveals a stark split within the cabinet, understood to be between, on one side, Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, Kwasi Kwarteng, the Business Secretary, and Michael Gove, responsible for improving the UK's homes, all seeing benefits to the strong climate action. And on the other hand, the Chancellor Rishi Sunak, a free market hawk, instinctively opposed to government intervention. All three papers are now expected to come later in the week, with the government seeking to preserve a show of unity over the publications. The row over the government's handling of COP26 planning has emerged amid public order concerns, with up to 150,000 protesters expected to take to streets in Glasgow in early November, alongside the crucial climate talks, which will require one of the largest policing operations ever undertaken in Britain. Countries and organizations planning to host events that also said they fear that increased costs will cause problems for developing nations. Multiple participants told The Guardian recently that the cost of renting COP26 pavilions, these are event spaces for hosting workshops, panel discussions and keynote speeches during the conference, is considerably higher than it was at COP25 in Madrid, Spain, with some saying it has increased by as much as 30%. A COP26 spokesperson said the organizers were working closely with sponsors, which would increase the value for money for taxpayers, and reduce the overall financial cost of COP26. A Whitehall veteran of COP summits said, "It feels like some of these sponsors have forgotten the actual reason we're in Glasgow. COP26 isn't about branding, it's about tackling climate change. Keeping 1.5 degrees Celsius in reach is the best thing you can do for your bottom line. They would do well to remember this."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies: 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
November 25th, 2018. In a meeting with government officials of the Islamic Republic of Iran, ambassadors of Islamic countries and participants of the 32 Conference on Islamic Unity, practicing Islamic unity will allow Muslims to overcome all the schemes of the enemies of Islam. The Holy Prophet. He was a bright sun who shone during the time of ignorance and Jahili deception, and who illuminated the world. As the Commander of the Faithful, peace and greetings be upon him, said, "While the world was devoid of brightness and full of open deceitfulness, this is the truth of the matter, the world was saturated with the darkness of Jahiliyyah and deception during the time when the God of the world presented that light to humanity. Today, the holy body of the Holy Prophet is not with us, but God sent him with guidance and true religion. His religion and his guidance are with us. If we follow this light and if we are among the people who are described as the ones who follow the light which is sent down with him, then the result is that it is they who will prosper." The Holy Quran, Surah 7, verse 157.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Obeying divine guidance and the light which he has sent down, this light is the Quran, as it is the book of guidance and light, and obeying this divine gift given by God through the Holy Prophet will help humanity to achieve bliss and salvation. Humanity is after bliss and salvation. From the beginning until today, the plight of humanity has been a lack of justice, mercy, and guidance. The various forms of ignorance that humanity has experienced have made life difficult for humanity. Today, humanity is in need of the same source of light. Today, too, humanity needs to accept the Holy Prophet's invitation, which is an invitation to the truth, to integrity, and to mercy. If humanity reaches such a level of intellectual maturity that it accepts the invitation of the Holy Prophet of Islam, then its maladies will be healed.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.